Hi, I'm Jillian Swinford.
And I'm Haley Brolison.
And this is Mother Nature Will Kill You,
a podcast about the most horrific tragedies
and the most triumphant survival stories that the wilderness can provide.
So grab your backpack
and maybe a bottle of wine.
And let's go on a wild ride into the unknown.
Walking down this road I go, but I am going alone. Running far, far from home, till I am but skin and bone. I don't wanna die, but I'll have to try. Oh, I don't wanna die, but I'm on my own.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good evening. What are we doing today? Good
afternoon. Whatever. I am recording live from Virginia. and so if there's any extra sounds in this room, I apologize because I am making do at my parents' house. Yes. So, you know, it's Thanksgiving's going to be next week. So we decided to record early so we didn't have to worry about any of that.
Yes.
Yeah. How are things going?
Things are going fine. It's been a really busy week for me. I have literally had something every evening besides Monday. So yeah. And I have to go up to Key Largo today for work. So my only day off is tomorrow, Sunday.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so thank you for hopping on and recording.
Oh no, it's all good. That's the way that this week has been going. It's just been a really busy week. We, like Tuesday, there was another benefit concert down in Key West. So I did that. Wednesday there was a storm. Oh my God. There was a storm that popped up. I'll have to tell you about that in a second. But Wednesday, there was this this event at the Fly Shop in Marathon. So I went there with my friends to support the Captains for Clean Water. Raised over $1,000 for Captains for Clean Water. So that was nice. Thursday was our friend's birthday. Yesterday, Friday, was the inaugural reef revival event that we hosted in Isla Mirada. And then today I go up to Key Largo for light up Key Largo to get the Christmas season going in the Upper Keys.
Busy.
Yeah, it's been a lot. And then ironically, last weekend, we decided to finish up our master bedroom with like the mudding and sanding. And then my optimistic brain and also like my like forgetful brain hit at the same time. And I was like, oh, like if we, you know, can mud and sand, you know, this was last weekend. I was like, then we can like do another layer Monday evening, do a little bit more sanding on Tuesday. And I was like, we can prime on Wednesday. Like I was like going through all this. And then I looked at my calendar and I was like, oh my God, I was like, I can't do any of that. And so, and Alex has had like a really busy week too. So he's over there sanding the rest of the stuff down. So if you hear any noise in the background, just let me know and I'll shut my door a little bit better. So
We're probably going to hear my mom's dog scream her head off at something or someone. She is a terrier mix and she lives up to it. So she got me real good. But there's like this scratch running down my chin because I was playing with her. Mom's like, you shouldn't rile her up like that. And I'm like, she's a dog.
She's a dog. That's funny. Of course.
She wants to play.
I feel that.
So, So I got in, I think Wednesday night, really late, because that's how we have to do it down in Texas.
Because
we have to drive 2.5 hours to the airport. So I got on really late Wednesday. So I've been here for 2 days now. It's been nice. It's just me and my parents right now, but my brother is coming in today. My mom's going to go pick him up in a bit. And then Corey is coming in on Tuesday. next week, and then my aunt, uncle, and my gram are coming on Monday. So it's going to be a full house
Oh,
next week.
yay. That's exciting. I'm happy for you. That's
What
exciting.
I am most happy about, though, is that the fall color is still here.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
That's nice.
So it's the first time I've gotten fall color, real fall color, in like 5 years. And I'm
Yeah.
just like vibing, and it's
Yes.
beautiful.
A fall queen. We love it.
Why do I live in Texas?
I know. When people ask me if I like living down here, or like if I, or like if I miss like Virginia, and I'm like, you know, it has its benefits for sure. I was like, I definitely miss the seasons, like the four seasons, but like I would rather travel to somewhere snowy and like get that snow experience than like
Fair.
live in the cold for like 3 months, you know? So it's like it's
Yeah.
the give and take, you know?
I mean, if I lived in the Keys, I'd also feel that way because the
Yeah.
water's beautiful and clear and like lovely all the time. But in Texas,
Yeah.
it's mud water unless you live like in Laguna Madre, and then you'll get some clear water. But where I
That's
live,
fair.
it's mud water. So
Yeah.
you don't even get that benefit.
Yeah. We
So.
the water down here looked really pretty against like the storm clouds, like you know when
Oh,
like the
yeah.
dark gray clouds are there and then it's like the emerald green waters and like that contrast, it looks really pretty. But yeah, that storm that I mentioned a little bit a while ago or at the beginning of this, it was like a tropical storm that just like popped up out of nowhere. And like I woke up Wednesday morning at 6, like let the dog out, normal, go to make the coffee. Typically, he like scratches or barks to be like let back in, but instead he was like whimpering aggressively. Like and I'm like, oh my God, like what is happening? So like I go to open,
Baby.
I know. So I go to like open the door and like the wind takes it and like it's pouring down rain. And like Waylon obviously does not like that kind of weather. And so I was like, oh dear God, like it's really coming down out there. Like that really changed over the course of like the 5, 10 minutes you were out there, huh? And I come back inside, I tell Alex, I'm like, oh, it's really coming down out there. Like, you know, what are you guys gonna do for work today? Like, you know. And he was like, is it? Because it doesn't really sound like that. And like, shit you not, like 10 minutes later, we get the National Weather Alert Service alarm blaring on our phone that there's a tornado warning for
Oh,
like
good.
our area. And I was like, this cannot be real. Like, what? And then like sure enough, I was reading it and like the funniest part is at the end, because like, you know, it's a standard like tornado warning message. So at the end it says, seek shelter immediately in a basement or like all this stuff. And I was like, yeah, sure, the basement that we all have here in the Keys.
Right.
Like
Literally, no one has a basement in
yeah.
the Keys. Literally.
And so I was like, I really would not even know what to do. Like, I know you're supposed to get in a bathtub and like put a mattress over you or something like that. But like, Alex was in the shower when that went off. And so I was like, and apparently that warning or like that alert went off after the tornado hit here.
Where did it hit? Like, did it actually hit land?
It hit behind us. Like,
What?
I'll show you a picture because I saw it on Facebook. The National Weather Service in Key West posted it. But it hit about like a quarter mile behind us.
Oh my
And I
God,
was like, oh shit. Like,
girl.
I was like, Waylon was probably outside when the tornado was. I was like, that poor dog. But
No
also,
wonder he was whimpering.
I know. Like, that's why when I put it all together, I was like, oh, no wonder. Like, that makes so much sense. But it only lasted like a minute. So, like,
Did it damage anybody's house or?
yeah. Like, so
Oh
that it
my
like started
gosh.
there and then went up there. And then,
Okay.
so Alex like took that screenshot. So like if it kept going, like the blue dot is where our house is. So like it started there and it went across
Oh
right
my
there.
God.
Yeah. So it would have just came right for us if it kept
My
going.
God. God, I
But
hate tornadoes.
yeah. So that was like the fun, eventful time on Wednesday. But the damage, like, yeah, there's like trees that are like uprooted and like siding got blown off and stuff. But like I like that that impact also hit like close to us too. Like I drove out of the neighborhood and like the house around the corner from us had like a tree just tilted over. And I was like, oh my God. But for us, I was like, everything is still on the porch the way that we left it. Like nothing's knocked over. That's like everything's so fine. So I was like, did a tornado really hit here? Because like, I just have a hard time believing that. Like everything is fine at our house. But yeah,
that's
that was
so funny.
Eventful.
Yeah.
No, it was just eventful. Like, I didn't think, like, water spouts happen all the time here. Yeah. But I was like, a tornado? Like, what the heck? And then that storm, like, just traveled up the Keys slowly the rest of the day. And then by the time it got to Isla Mirada around, like, 7 p.m., like, it actually had an eye. Like, it was swirling. Like, up there, they got, like, 19 inches of rain. In the day. And so, like, everything up there is, like, all flooded and stuff. And then down here, like, you know, things were flooded, parking lots were flooded, like you're walking in like ankle deep water. Marathon got the monthly, they beat the monthly average and the daily average for rain in one day.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's impressive considering November's still hurricane season, right?
Yeah, it's like the end of it. And so I think the last time, it's going to take me too long to find this, but like, I think the last time that that much rain fell was like in the 80s. Wow. Is what I think I saw online.
Yeah. So, yeah. I know there was a big front moving across the Southeast because we were pretty rainy for like 4 days before I came here. But no, we don't have any tornadoes or hurricanes or anything.
Yeah.
It's funny though. I was just talking to my mom, my friend about how when Corey and I were getting married at our rehearsal dinner, there was a tornado that touched down a mile away from our venue.
Oh my God, that's scary.
And we were all at the venue.
Oh. Like just having a great time.
Well, no, we knew. We got the warning. So we got everybody like in the middle, like because it was a barn, right? And so what was really funny is we had our Finnish friend and her husband now, who's from Belgium, so they know nothing of tornadoes. They don't. But Ronia knew enough. So she was like getting in the center with all of us because she was like, "I've seen, like, I've heard your stories. I'm not dealing with this tornado stuff." And her husband was out at the windows trying to take pictures and like opening the door,
like all the things you're not supposed to be doing.
He was like, "I want to see if I can see it, babe."
Yeah.
Like, you tall, weird European man, get over
get
here.
Get back in here. Yeah, that's fair.
So, if somebody got lost in Big Bend this week.
I saw that. I sent you that, I think, right? Or I screenshot it and I meant to send it to you and I didn't.
I don't somebody know. Got... I saw it on the news. There's not a lot of information out about it.
Is this the one where the dog survived?
No.
Oh, I saw something else then.
Well, maybe she did have a dog. I don't know.
Oh, no, it wasn't a she. It was a he. So there's two different stories then.
Wait, two people got lost in Big Bend?
I don't know. Maybe it's not Big Bend anymore. I gotta see if I sent it to you over Instagram or not.
Well, I heard about this
I didn't,
one.
But I screenshot it. So tell me about that, and then I'll bring this up. Sorry.
So a hiker went missing in Big Bend National Park, which if you listen to the podcast, you'll know Corey and I went about, I think, a year ago around this time. This woman, Christy Perry, who's 25 years old, was missing since November 9th.
Yeah.
And I believe they found her on the 17th.
Oh, wow.
So that's a long time to be missing.
Yeah, it really is.
In a desert. But so Big Bend National Park is one of the two national parks in Texas. It's a big deserty area, but it does have mountains as well, and it can get very, very cold at night. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to read this ABC News article. A hiker who's been missing for over a week in Big Bend National Park has been found safe, according to authorities. Christy Perry, 25, had been missing since November 9th. She did not show up for her camping reservation at the Texas National Park, according to the National Park Service. We are pleased to report a successful search and rescue operation at Big Bend National Park. They shared on Facebook. Our highly skilled team, in collaboration with outside law enforcement, had located and safely rescued the missing hiker. Perry is under medical care and is being transported to a hospital in Odessa, officials said.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So she traveled from Houston to Big Bend, in Southwest Texas, which I can attest is a long drive.
Yes.
It's like definitely 9 hours, probably, or more from Houston. She picked up a rental car in Midland, Texas, and arrived at the park on November 9th, according to the Park Service. She did not show up at her campsite that evening in the Chisos Basin campground, according to the Park Service, which Chisos Basin is where Corey and I stayed as well. And it's this
Okay.
big, it's almost like a like an ecological island. It's just this big group of mountains that's just standing out in the middle of the desert, like an island, literally. It's so wild. And so the environment's different up there. So it's like there's actual like pine forests. It gets quite cold at night. It's not as hot and dry as the Chihuahua Desert, which is like what the rest of the park is.
And what's this called again? The area?
The Chisos Basin.
Chisos Basin. I'm gonna Google
Yeah.
it while you're talking. Sorry.
Yeah, go for it. It's friggin' beautiful. So Perry's last known location before she went missing was the beginning of the park's Lost Mine Trail, which Corey and I were debating doing. There were two trails, the Window Trail and Lost Mine Trail in this
Oh, no
area.
way.
And we went with Window Trail, the
Oh
Window Trail
my
instead.
gosh, how
Yeah.
eerie is that for you to look back on and be like,
I
oh wow, the
know.
same trail that she did, huh?
Yeah, so her vehicle was located at the trailhead, according to the Park Service. Big Bend's National Park's Lost Mine Trail has been closed due to the search. Search teams were made up of park employees, U.S. Border Patrol, Texas Game Wardens, and two canine teams, and the Los Diablos fire crew were combing through the surrounding canyons and ridges. U.S. Customs and Border Protection also conducted an aerial search by helicopter. So, if you remember, Big Bend is right on the border between the United States and Mexico. So, that's not that surprising that they helped with the search.
Yeah.
Lost Mine Trail, which climbs steeply through the woodlands of the Chisos Mountains, is 4.8 miles in a round trip. So, it's not necessarily like the craziest, longest trail. But I do know there's a lot of different connecting trails up in that area that if
Okay.
you didn't have a map or didn't read the map correctly, you probably could get lost.
Okay.
And I think that's all the information we really have. We don't have much info on her condition or like how she made
Is
it
doing,
through all of
yeah.
that.
Well, at
It's
least she's
still,
still alive. That's good news.
yeah, that is good news. But so yeah, Big Bend National Park, you gotta be safe when you're out in that one because it is big. It is a big
Yeah,
park. Yeah.
I
So
am. I'm looking at photos of all of it right now, and it is large and a desert, but it looks really pretty too. So,
But the Chisos Mountains are like this weird little bit that just juts out and it's
yeah.
like it's still, arid and deserty, but there's like actual forests and stuff, which is interesting.
Yeah, that is
Yeah.
interesting. It looks really pretty.
Yeah, I would be terrified to be lost there though, because there are mountain lions, like a lot of them,
Oh,
and bears.
I did see some pictures of bears when I was looking at photos.
Yeah.
Yes,
Like
I would
when,
be not okay.
no, when we were there, Corey had his head on a swivel because he just decided that he was going to start being afraid of mountain lions when we went
Oh,
there. And I was like,
yeah.
Corey, this is the worst time to like be like super freaked out about
Yeah, like you
it.
chose right now to do that. That's funny. Hey, at least he was aware, alert and aware.
Yeah, trying his best. All
Yeah.
right, so what was the one you sent me?
It was I have not a lot of information about it, but it says missing Colorado hiker found dead with his alive dog still by his side 2 months later.
Oh
So,
my
and I saw this on
gosh.
Instagram. So it says loyal dog survives 10 weeks in Colorado mountains following owner's passing. After accompanying her owner on a hiking trip in the Colorado mountains, a dog was left stranded for over 10 weeks following her owner's death from hypothermia. Remarkably, the dog stayed by the owner's side and managed to survive even after losing half of her body weight. It has been a few months
Worth
since the
me.
incident, and the dog has successfully recovered her weight. So that's all. That's
That's
all I
so
saw.
sad.
I know. It is really sad.
Oh, we don't deserve dogs.
We really don't.
Like,
Not at all.
Go, yeah,
Not at
I
all.
know. Anytime I hear a story like that, I'm like, where's my dog? Let me go hug my dog for a little
Yeah.
bit. And Marcy's just like, what is happening?
I know. I like was thinking about Waylon and I was like, he would not stay with me for sure.
Hey, I
He
don't
would
know.
probably be like, all right, I'm finally free.
Bye, bye, Mom.
But I will say he does follow me around the house pretty like often.
Yeah.
Like as for aloof as he is, like he still wants to be around people, you know? Like the other day he was like, I guess on the bed and I came in to get something from the room and then I went back out and like was like watching TV on the couch and he just like got off the bed and like hopped up on the couch and like, you know,
In the
sat
middle,
next to me. But
yeah.
like he doesn't like snuggle sit next to you, but he wants to still like sit next to you, you know? So yeah, he
Yeah.
just wants to be around people even though he's not much of a snuggler.
So he's like a cat. They like
Pretty much.
pretend like they don't want to be around people, but they really
Yeah,
do.
for sure. But it
Marzie is my little shadow. So I don't know. She might stay, maybe not for 10 weeks, but she might. I could see her staying by my side for a while before
yeah.
she ate me. She might eat me,
That's
though.
what I was thinking. I was like, Waylon would probably eat me. Honestly, he'd be
I
like,
could see
Mom,
it. Like, I love
Mom,
her,
you,
but.
yeah. Oh man, yeah, he would eat me. That's okay. I get it. But, you
Yeah.
know, I'll donate my body to keep him alive.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, if Marcy wants to eat me, she can eat me, but she's voracious, so I feel like it would happen. You
Yeah.
know, she'd stay around me for like sadness and grieving for like a week, and then about a weekend she'd be like, "All right, Mom, this enough's enough. Let me
Yeah.
get a hold of that leg."
Time to go. Oh my God. So morbid, but so
Yeah.
funny. Yeah.
So that's a damn good dog, because
Yeah,
it doesn't sound like they tried to, you know.
I don't know the whole story of like how they got lost or like what the condition was, like hypothermia, all that stuff. I don't know anything about that. But that's what I saw. And I meant to
Well,
send it to you, but I didn't.
it's
So
okay. Well,
sorry.
it's easy to do to get lost and get hypothermia in some of these places. Like we were
Yeah.
talking about Mount Washington. A couple weeks ago when we did the Appalachian episode.
Yep.
And I guess I made an oopsie about that because
Oh.
my dad was, well, not an oopsie, but I need to like clarify because I totally forgot. My dad was the one who reminded me.
Successfully climbed it.
Yeah.
Mr. Swinford wants his clout.
Yep,
To
he does.
the two people that listens to this podcast.
Which, like, fair. And he made a post about it, and then he said, "Oh yeah, and then Mount Washington is the deadliest mountain in the world, in the United States, and do you know why?" And I had like heard that fact before, and so he's not the only person who's told me about it. Let's
Yeah.
clarify. But yeah, he did mention it like a couple months ago, and then it reminded me to, oh yeah, it's part of the AT, so why don't we do it on that episode? So
Yeah.
here's his due. He gets his due.
That's true.
Yes.
I mean, that's awesome that he successfully climbed that.
Yeah, he's done a lot of mountains actually. He's done Pikes Peak as well in Colorado.
Oh, I took the train up there,
Yeah,
but
me
I didn't
too.
but I didn't hike up there.
It's a tall one.
It is. I mean, even just like taking the train up there, I was getting like altitude-y, sickness-y, you know, like
Yes.
the kind of lightheaded and the ears were popping. I was like, oof. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's done that. He's done Pikes Peak. I know he's done a bunch. But though that's a notable one. And then I know he attempted Rainier, Mount Rainier in
Okay.
Washington.
Yeah.
But there was a snowstorm at the top that like forced them to turn back. So he made a good decision.
I was gonna say, smart, smart.
To not summit. But yeah, I'm sure he'll inform me after he hears this, a full list of successful summits.
I would love to hear that list, Mr. Spunford, just for
Yeah.
the record.
All right.
Awesome.
Should we dive in?
Let's dive in.
So last week we talked about the Titanic.
Yes, we did.
in its full glory, and I finally watched the stinking movie, and it's a long ass movie. So
it is. You have to dedicate like, time to that.
Yeah, I was sick, so that's the time I'm thinking. I was like, well, I'm gonna be on the couch anyway. So if you don't know anything about the Titanic, like at all, you can go back to I believe it's episode 71. And what did we title it? Most erotic moment. That's what we titled
yes.
it. So show me the
had
episode
to be done.
Before this one and get the full skinny, or if you want, you know, all the details of exactly what happened and like what transpired.
Yeah.
But I mean, everybody knows Titanic sank, lots of people died. So today we're going to talk about two of the notable survivors of the event and kind of clarifying some of their stories, because I've heard of both of these people before, and I thought completely different things about them, and I didn't know all of their like background information. And then we're going to talk about a conspiracy theory.
I love a conspiracy theory.
So the first survivor that we're going to talk about is the unsinkable Molly Brown.
Ooh, tell me more.
Which I've heard of her before. I thought that she had survived multiple sinkings.
Oh.
And the Titanic was one of them. But no, that is not what happened.
Oh.
And I don't know if that's something that's got spread around the internet, or if I'm just like thinking of another person that survived multiple sinkings.
Yeah.
So I always thought that she was like a survivor of multiple shipwrecks. She's not, but she was on the Titanic and she did survive the Titanic.
Okay.
And she's played by Kathy Bates in the movie.
Oh,
she's that character.
Okay. Yes. You did talk about that when you were texting me about the movie.
Yeah. So that's her character in the movie. Both of these people are featured in the movie. She has definitely like a bigger role than our other person that we're going to talk about today. So,
gotcha.
So, but she has a really interesting life. She's very much the epitome of like the American dream, you know?
Yeah.
So she was born as Margaret Tobin to Irish immigrants, John and Joanna Tobin, in 1867 in Hannibal, Missouri. And as Margaret, she was never personally called Molly in her life.
Oh.
Like the people who knew her did not call her Molly.
That's interesting.
But she got the nickname Molly Brown. And we'll talk why, you know. So she was the epitome of the American dream, as her parents were immigrants during the first period of industrialization in the U.S. And by the end of her life, she was a wealthy Denver socialite, which that's a pretty big jump.
Yeah.
So the Tobins had progressive views and valued education even for their daughters, but Margaret had to work in a tobacco factory as young as age 13 out of necessity for the family. Because they didn't have any money. So everybody was working pretty much.
Yeah.
And at the time, there weren't really child labor laws. So she dealt with long days and low wages. We didn't have, you know, minimum wage yet. We didn't have, you know, 8-hour work days that we didn't have like a weekend, you know. So that was what she was experiencing. Super fun. So one of her dreams was to move west. So she and her brother Daniel moved west to Leadville, Colorado, as young adults to try to make their fortune. She began working at a local department store in Leadville. She began to get involved with charity efforts, although she didn't have much herself, but she began like working in soup kitchens in town.
Yeah.
Which is like, I always struggle with the whole charity thing because I'm like, I barely have like enough for me, but like I want to, you know.
I know. And it like you feel like an asshole when you're like, no, I don't want to give money to a cancer society for children, you know.
Yeah.
But it's like I literally can't spend $20 more right now because then I'm poor too.
Yeah, it's so that's cool that she even did that
then. Yeah.
And this drive for charity continued throughout her entire life. So after her arrival to Leadville, she met mining engineer J.J. Brown, a man with a lot of prospects and who was considered respectable, but he didn't have a fortune. So he was pretty broke too.
Yeah.
But they fell in love and they were married September 1st, 1886. So she married for love, which
I love like that.
Is also rare for that time period.
For sure, rare. Yeah. Yes, for sure.
All right,
but I love
so
that.
Then, yes, I love love.
I love love.
So then they moved to this town, and this town name is the funniest fucking thing. They moved to Stumpf Town.
Dump Town?
Stumpf.
Oh, PH?
STUMPFTOWN. Stumpf.
Stumpf Town? That's funny.
They moved to Stumpf Town, Colorado, closer to the mine where JJ was working. The fortunes of Leadville, however, came crashing down in 1893 with the silver crash. But JJ managed to make a fortune during this time with his discovery of gold in the Little Johnny Mine. Oh. So he was a primary shareholder in the Ibex Mining Company, and he and Margaret became millionaires almost overnight. So
wow.
They literally, you know, the gold rush, they actually did that and did it successfully.
That's crazy.
Right? So she literally went from like poor immigrant to socialite overnight.
And that like time period of like the gold rush and stuff, like that just like always fascinates me.
Yeah. Yeah. And some people did strike it rich, but like I feel like most people did not. So Margaret was now part of the new money class. New money. And the Browns moved to the bustling Colorado city of Denver. Even though they moved away from the mines, the poverty following the silver crash was everywhere in the city as slums began growing on the outskirts of town. And I believe the silver crash was like the silver lost like a lot of market value, I believe. I don't know exactly how that all.
How does that happen? I know you just said you don't know, but it's like I will never understand how like something loses its value, like silver. I feel like that's always valuable, you know.
Well, but if you flood the market with silver, then
it's like saturated, and it's like anybody can get it. So
I guess I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't see the value in gold. Like we just made that up. It's just a metal. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't really understand it all either.
Yeah, I don't get it.
So, but because of this, there were a lot of poor people, a lot of slums. So Margaret quickly joined the progressive movement to install public baths in the courthouse and advocate for more public parks and city improvements. She also worked with the controversial reformer Ben Lindsay, a Denver judge who pioneered the creation of the first juvenile court system west of the Mississippi.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Right? I mean, it had to have started sometime. We didn't give a crap about kids back then. So.
No.
Yeah.
Like, what year is this? 1867, 1886, 1893, like the late 1800s?
When Turn was of the century.
When was Billy the Kid a thing?
I don't know.
I'm going to look it up because that's like one thing that sticks out to me when it comes to like juvenile court system is like, okay, like there is literally like a teenage murderer out there and like nobody did a thing about it. Like,
yeah. Well, he was running around the Wild West. So
yes, it was, he was born in 1859 and he died in 1881. So this is, before the juvenile court system.
Yeah.
West of the Mississippi.
Yep. So along with newfound riches, the Browns enjoyed travel and traveled throughout both Europe and Asia at the turn of the century. Margaret would write travel articles about their adventure for the Denver papers. Unfortunately, in 1909, after 23 years of marriage, she and JJ quietly signed separation papers.
Aw.
I know. Margaret received a cash settlement, a substantial monthly allotment, and their house in Denver. So she's still doing just fine.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily think there was, like, ill will, because they never actually got divorced. They were just separated, and he never, like, made it difficult for her to be taken care of or anything. They
yeah, that's
kind of grew
parted
apart.
Ways. Yeah.
So in 1912, at age 44, Margaret was more independent than ever and had departed on a trip to Egypt with her friends. News of her ill grandson forced her... forced an early return to the States, so she booked a passage on the Titanic.
Oh, shit. This is where comes into play.
Yep. So this was the first available ship. What luck.
What luck. But honestly, what luck? She freaking survived. So, like, you know, yeah, she really, did. Really, what luck?
So while on the Titanic, obviously she was first class, so she could, you know, enjoy all the first class amenities. So one notable thing is she enjoyed exercising using the ship's gymnasium and liked boxing with the punching bag so much that she took it up after surviving the wreck. So she is...
That's one way to get your anger out. Just, right? Like, dealing with your trauma by going boxing.
Well, it's just funny because, like, that was not done by women, too, back in the day. So I could just picture all these men coming up to work out, and then here's this, like, high society woman just punching the crap out of a bag. All right, so Margaret described her experience the night of the crash, saying, "I stretched out on the brass bed at the side of which was a lamp. So completely absorbed in my reading, I gave little thought to the crash that struck at my window overhead and threw me on the floor.
Oh, God.
She went out to the hall to investigate and said, I again looked out and saw a man whose face was blanched, his eyes protruding, wearing the look of a haunted creature.
Oh, I don't like
he was
that.
Gasping
That's creepy.
For breath, and in an undertone, he gasped, get your lightsaber. Up on deck, she did not get into the first lifeboat launched, instead helping women and children into other lifeboats, stating, somehow I did not seem to care about the thing of being saved.
Yeah.
She was doing this when she was taken a hold of by two Americans, American merchants, Edward P. Calderhead and James McGaw, and practically thrown, dropping 4 feet into the already lowering lifeboat number 6. She states that she owes her life to them.
I bet.
So they were literally, like, throwing women into
off the boat.
So.
Jeez Louise, that's scary.
Yeah, it would have been wild in its own right. So.
Mm-hmm.
So the boat was supposed to hold 65 people, but launched with 21 women and 2 men and a 12-year-old boy on board. So, again, they were underfilling the boats, right?
Yeah.
The woman rowed for hours due to Brown's urging to get them to try to stay warm. Margaret decided to take off her own life jacket, thinking she'd rather drown than stay afloat in the freezing water and suffer until she died, which...
Wow.
I get that.
Yeah.
Because people died, like, within 15 minutes of hitting that water.
Yeah. Right.
So after the ship disappeared, she urged Quartermaster Robert Hitchens, who was in charge of the lifeboat, to look for survivors, as there was plenty of room on the lifeboat. But Hitchens was determined to row the ship the boat as far away as possible from the sinking ocean liner and the panicked people now splashing around in the water. The lifeboat was about a mile and a half away from the ship when it did sink. Although, right? So they like were like, fuck them people, we're leaving.
Yes. Like, get out of here.
That's a ways away. So although she didn't actually see the sinking, she noted a great sweep of water went over the boat, and the other passengers on her lifeboat all knew that the steamer was gone. So that's when they knew.
Mm-hmm.
Hitchens was reluctant to return to find survivors, and Margaret stated He told us we had no chance. After he explained that we had no food, no water, and no compass, I told him to be still or he would go overboard.
Shut the fuck up or I'm gonna throw you over.
Yeah. Like, she's like, I'm not having this.
Yeah.
So Margaret and the women actually did save one man from the water, whom she then put to work with rowing and gave him some of her own clothing for warmth.
Oh, wow.
So they were one of the few that actually managed to rescue anybody from the water.
That's crazy.
So she gave him her own clothes.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So the other passengers in the lifeboat refer to her as Lady Margaret and as the strength of them all for her bravery.
Yes.
By 4:30 a.m., she saw a flash of light from the approaching ship, the Carpathia, which rescued everybody. So after pulling aside the ship, all occupants of the lifeboat were rescued. Although she was cold and tired, she immediately took action as she had a good knowledge of foreign languages and began consoling survivors and distributing supplies. Knowing that many had lost everything, she rallied the first class passengers to donate money to the second and third class passengers.
Aww.
And had raised $10,000 before the Carpathia had even reached New York.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
So she is like this amazing philanthropist because she knows what it's like to have no money.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, I'm in love with her. She's great.
Yeah. I'm like, I'm just curious, like, what her persuasive, like, social communication game was with all of that too, because it's like, you know, those people just were through a shipwreck as well, and like,
yeah,
they lost things, so they're,
yeah,
I don't know, I would be in the mindset of like, well, I just lost things too, so
right.
But I guess if you have like a lot of money like they do, then they're probably fine.
Yeah, well, she must have been very charismatic too, I would think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So rumors stated that Margaret stepped off the Carpathia in New York, exclaiming, typical brown luck, I'm unsinkable.
Oh my God.
But in reality, journalist Polly Pry, who was a Denver gossip columnist, created the nickname the unsinkable Molly Brown, and it has stuck ever since then.
I gotcha. That's how that happened, huh?
Yeah. So the aftermath of this experience placed her in the national limelight. She continued helping survivors of the event and continued her reform work. She served as a mediator to the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company strike in Colorado in 1914. A strike was started in a bloodbath in which 20 people were killed.
Oh, my God.
Yes. But ended with Brown convincing the Rockefeller to make concessions with the striking miners. So
wow.
She mediated a strike for fun, I guess. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
Just doing this.
That's crazy.
Yeah. She also worked with Alva Vanderbilt Belmont to organize the and lead aspects of the suffragette movement, including organizing the National Women's Trade Union League to advocate for minimum wage and 8-hour workdays for women of all classes. Due to her rising to the national stage for women's issues, she proposed a bid for a political seat for U.S. Senator representing Colorado. And newspapers in the New York Times favored her victory. Unfortunately, when World War I broke out, she shifted into organizing relief efforts and traveling to France to do so and let go of her Senate dreams. Which I'm like, I want that lady to be senator. Screw everybody else.
Yeah.
Like, please. Following the success of the suffragette movement and the end of World War I, she pursued her interest in the stage for the rest of her life. She passed away in 1932 in her sleep, living her life on her own terms and pursuing her own ambitions, free, liberated, and self-sufficient. And
aww,
that is the true story of the unsinkable Molly Brown.
Awesome. I love that.
I know. And I have
what
some
a badass.
Lovely pictures of her. And one where she is giving an award to, I believe, one of the first officers that survived the Titanic sinking.
Oh, yeah.
So
wow, look at that hat.
I know. Iconic.
Yes. Iconic is right.
All right, so this second person that we're going to talk about probably shouldn't have survived.
Oh, no, why not?
well, like, not like, oh, I don't want him to survive, but, like, I don't know how this human being survived.
Oh, okay, like, okay, yeah, like, gotcha.
Because, first of all, he was a crew member, and a lot of them died. So,
aww.
Right, because they were putting passengers first, the only crew members that survived were the people who were in charge of the lifeboats.
Yeah.
So, this is the story of Charles... Oh, you know what? I never looked up how to say this. Hold on.
Jockin.
Oh, guess so. Jockin. Would not have guessed that.
Huh. That's interesting.
Okay. So, this is the true story of Charles Jockin, the famous Titanic pastry chef.
Pastry chef. I love it already.
Charles Jockin was born in Birkenhead, England, 1878, to Father John Edwin and Ellen Jockin. He followed in the footsteps of his brothers, who had joined the Royal Navy and began working aboard ships at age 11. On the 17th of November in Liverpool, he married Louise Woodward and had a daughter, Agnes Lillian, in 1907, and a son, Roald Ernest, in 1909. Huh. Eventually, this led to a position on the RMS Titanic as head baker when the ship hit the iceberg the evening of April 14th, 1912. He was to receive monthly wages of £12, which was equivalent to 1,580 pounds today, and had a staff of 13 bakers under him. I'm like, that's not a great, I mean, that's maybe $2,000.
Yeah.
It's not the best wage, even then, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But there he was. So he was woken by the collision, finding the ship's staff in disarray and lacking leadership. So he immediately began taking control of the situation, having the bakers bring 50 loaves of bread to the deck for the lifeboats to make sure everyone would have food to last until they were rescued. So that guy on Margaret Brown's boat was totally wrong. They should have had bread.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So when he and his fellow bakers had completed supplying the lifeboats, he calmly returned to his room and had a drink of liquor. Because same.
Yeah. It's like, I need a drink for this.
Yeah. And then returned to his assigned lifeboat. So he was assigned to be the captain of lifeboat 10.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But instead of getting in, he and Chief Officer Henry Tingle Wilde and a group of men forced women and children into the boats, likely saving their lives.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So a lot of the reasons why the women and children were not getting into the boats were because they were convinced that they were going to be safer aboard the Titanic and afraid to get in the lifeboats, which I guess at that point, the sinking wasn't as noticeable.
Yeah.
Yet. Okay. Even though, like, they knew for sure they were going to sink. And I think that happens in a lot of those situations because it's scary to be on a little lifeboat in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, it's so dark out there.
Right? And you don't really know who's coming to rescue you or if you will drift away from the site of the wreck.
Yeah.
You know? So it's scary. So having given up his seat, he returned to his room again and had another drink. According to him, a tumbler half full of liquor. So I'm just imagining like a whiskey, like rocks glass maybe.
Yeah.
And he was seemingly unfazed by the water that was now entering his cabin. So he then made his way back up on deck and began throwing deck chairs overboard, helping to give to those who were in the water something to cling to so that they might stay alive.
Oh, smart. Okay, he's trying.
He is trying. So he threw about 50 chairs overboard. And they found a lot of the survivors, like, well, not the survivors. They found a lot of the victims, the ones who died, like, clinging to these chairs. So
aww.
If the water hadn't been as cold as it was, you know.
It could have,
maybe would have made a difference.
Yeah.
After returning below deck to drink just a glass of water this time, you know, get a little glass of water before going to bed.
Yeah. Let me hydrate.
Yep. So he then heard a crash as if something had buckled, and that was the Titanic breaking in two, which we talked about in the prior episode.
Yeah.
So Jochen said of himself during this experience, there was no great shock or anything. So he's like super calm.
Yeah. He's like, yeah, figured this is going to happen.
Right. But he did immediately make his way to the stern of the ship and hung on to the railing. So as we know, the stern before it sank went completely upright.
Oh, right? Wow. Yeah.
And in the movie, Rose and Jack ride the stern all the way down.
Yes.
And there is a man in a baker, like, chef's coat.
Yes. Is that him?
And he has a flask with him.
Yes. Yes, I remember.
And he's next to them. That's him.
Oh, wow. That's so crazy.
Yeah. So he actually did ride the stern of the ship all the way down, just, you know, tightening his life belt, shifting items around in his pockets, and calmly, you know, stood there wondering what to do next when she went.
Oh, so, man.
Because of this, Jochen may have been the last person to enter the water.
Wow, that's crazy.
Which is what Rose and Jack were trying to do, to stay out of the water as long as possible. So I think that's where James Cameron got that idea from.
Yeah.
So stories depict him as stepping off the ship without as much as getting his hair wet. And this rumor does match his personal accounts as well, because he says of the ordeal, I stepped off as the ship went under, and had expected a suction of some kind, but felt none. At no time was my head underwater. Just kept moving my arms and legs and kept in an upright position. So this is like the calmest man on the planet.
I think it probably has something to do with the amount of liquor he consumed before.
Yes, but
before this happened.
It's not like he considered it, like consumed a ton of liquor. You know, he had like two drinks, right?
Yeah, and he was like, all right, we're going down.
Yeah.
Casual.
So as he entered the water, he decided to remain calm, because you just decide to do that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just decide to remain calm.
So he paddled and treaded water, supposedly staying afloat for 2.5 hours. But
oh my God, really?
That's his account. We don't know for sure if it was actually that long, because when you're in an experience like that, you know, sometimes time gets weird, you know?
Yeah.
So for most people, entering the water caused immediate cold shock, as Second Officer Charles Lightroller recalled, striking the water was like 1,000 knives being driven into one's body.
Oof. Yeah, I bet.
Most people would drown in minutes due to the shock and panic, but not Jochen.
Yeah, because he's like super calm, cool, connected.
Yeah. He's a superhuman. Like,
yeah.
Finally, with the first rays of sunlight, he spotted an overturned lifeboat, collapsible boat B, and swam towards it. It had about 30 people standing on top of the overturned boat, including Second Officer Charles Lightroller, but there was no room for Jochen, so he started to swim away.
Like, oh, wow.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
So, the cook, Isaac Maynard, recognized Jochen and held out his hand to Jochen, who held on to the side of the boat with his feet and his legs still in the water for a while longer.
Oh, wow. That's so crazy. While, yeah, you're right. How did this guy survive?
I don't. Like, everybody else died within 45 minutes except for this man, apparently.
Yeah.
So while his legs were in the water, his core was out of the water, which would have prolonged his survival.
Wow.
Another lifeboat appeared soon after, and Jochen swam to it and was taken in, where he stayed until help arrived. Soon after, the survivors of the Titanic were rescued by the Carpathia, and other than swollen feet, the baker showed no signs of injury from his time in the water.
Get out of here.
This man's like
That's crazy.
So supposedly it was his calm demeanor, the fact that he stayed out of the water as long as possible, combined with his intake of alcohol that saved his life. Many people have debated as to what exactly caused his unlikely survival. And yeah. many stories depict him as like completely drunk.
Like, well, it seems to be that way. I mean, you could totally run with it the way that he was like, oh, I had a drop of liquor before, you know.
So many stories depict him as completely drunk, inebriated, heavily drinking. And it's true that he did have a couple of drinks, but it's unlikely that he was actually wasted when the ship went down.
Yeah.
So he probably had like a couple fingers of whiskey with each drink, which if you don't drink a lot, then yeah, you'd probably get drunk from that. But he seems like a man who's probably had a few drinks in his life, you know?
Yeah, definitely, for sure.
So it probably didn't make him drunk, right?
Yeah.
And the reason this is because alcohol actually increases your risk of hypothermia in a couple of ways.
Yeah, because it like thins your blood out, right?
Yeah. Like you feel warmer.
Yeah.
But you're not actually warmer.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So one, it increases vasodilation, like you said, which results in increased blood flow to the skin and leads to more heat loss.
Mm-hmm.
It also disrupts your normal temperature regulation processes in the body and inhibits decision-making skills, obviously, including, you know, the life-saving kind of decision-making skills. So
yes.
So the interesting thing is that I didn't really realize. So when humans fall in water, they rarely die of hypothermia. Instead, they suffer from the cold shock response.
Oh, that's interesting.
So most of the time, they don't actually live long enough to see their core body temperature drop to critical levels.
Oh.
They succumb first to either drowning or cardiac arrest.
So are you saying that this guy pretty much had the right idea by, like, remaining calm, cool, and collected?
Yeah. It saved his life, literally.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So when humans enter water colder than 15 degrees Celsius, they inhale involuntarily and breathe rapidly, which can quickly lead to drowning if water enters your mouth. Cold water also triggers constriction of blood vessels, leading to increases in blood pressure or cardiac arrest. But he had drinking some alcohol, so that didn't happen.
Yes.
So if you get through that part of the experience, then the body begins shutting down peripheral muscles, so like your arms and legs, to reserve heat for your core. So exhaustion in your arms and legs becomes a bigger issue. And drowning can happen if one doesn't have a flotation device.
That's crazy.
So it's not so much the cold, like, making you hypothermic. It's your body being like, oh my God.
Yeah, like, what is happening?
So while it's possible that his blood alcohol content helped him stay calm and avoid the cold shock response, it's unlikely that he was truly drunk because he wouldn't have been able to make a lot of those decisions.
I wonder, like, if he knew all of this about the human body, and that's why he's like, I'm gonna go get a few drinks in me.
I doubt it.
Yeah.
I doubt it. Like, I didn't know. And I science is my thing, right?
Yes. It really is.
So he probably just, like any of us would, been like, I need a drink because I am probably dealing with this tonight.
Yes.
Right?
Like, if I'm gonna go down, I might as well go down drunk.
Right. So Jochen himself said that he only had, quote unquote, a drop of liquor by his own account. It's more likely that he was lucky, calm, had a life jacket, and spent less time in the water that was estimated. And the alcohol probably helped with the calmness and dealing with the whole cardiac arrest issue.
Yeah.
So after the event, he continued his life at sea when he joined the Merchant Navy.
Oh my God.
To Bacon on the High Seas.
That is crazy.
Yep. He did testify about the sinking at the British Wreck Commissioner's Inquiry. Unfortunately, his wife, Louise, died in 1919 in childbirth, and their new son, Richard, was also lost. In 1920, he moved permanently to the U.S., to Paterson, New Jersey, and continued to serve on ships operated by American Export Lines. Hmm. He also served on World War II troop transports before retiring in 1944. He married Annie Eleanor Call, another English immigrant, but she passed in 1943.
Aww.
He died in 1956 at the age of 78, which is pretty old for then.
Yes. Oh, my God. Yeah, it is.
And his character was portrayed in the 1958 film A Night to Remember, the Titanic, as we know, and as well as an episode of Drunk History. So,
yes.
So that is the story of Charles Jochen, the famous Titanic baker.
Nice.
And he was not drunk.
I've
heard the story before, and everyone's like, oh yeah, he just got wasted and that's how he survived. And it's like, and no, like, no,
that didn't happen.
There's more to it than that.
Yes. Wow. Crazy though. That's cool.
So now, you know, like if you're going down in a ship in the North Atlantic, it's not the worst idea to have a couple of nips of whiskey.
Yes, definitely not the worst.
It might actually save your life. So,
how wild is that?
Yep,
that's neat.
So, yeah, these are real survival facts. Alcohol may help in certain situations.
I love that.
All right, so do you want to talk conspiracy theories?
I do. Yes. Okay. I would love that.
I gave Haley the option of two theories, and this is one she picked, and it was funny because I had already like started researching it.
Yes, I love that though. Like, it's good.
Okay, so this is a conspiracy theory that I feel like a lot of people have seen on like, TikTok, because that's where I first heard, and then you told me
about I saw it on TikTok too though.
Yeah, and this is because OceanGate happened.
Yes.
The explosion of the Titan sub on its way down to the wreck. And so I think that like brought the interest of the Titanic back to like the public mind.
Mm-hmm.
And supposedly that's when this conspiracy kind of like went crazy viral on the internet.
Yeah.
So it is one of the biggest and most widespread Titanic conspiracies, is that the Titanic never sank, instead was switched with one of its sister ships, the Olympic, before it began
sailing. Yes.
So it's actually a decades old conspiracy theory, but it's been revived by social media after the OceanGate fiasco.
Mm-hmm.
But the motives for why the ship was switched varies. So one motive said the switch occurred as part of an insurance fraud scheme, because the Olympic actually was damaged in an accident and its owners wanted to deliberately sink the ship to receive some kind of payment for it instead of paying to fix it.
Uh-huh.
Another, and this is probably the more infamous conspiracy theory, say that it was intended to kill three powerful businessmen who were supposedly opposed to the creation of the central banking system in the U.S., the Federal Reserve. These men were Benjamin Guggenheim, Isidore Strauss, and John Jacob Astor. And Isidore Strauss, I believe, did die on the Titanic.
Okay. Okay.
There is also a photo floating around claiming to be the Titanic in a scrapyard in 1935. But, like, I don't know about that. Because you could just literally change the date. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, how do you prove that, right?
Yeah.
So, in addition, the Olympic got in a collision with another ship in September of 1911, so the year before the Titanic left, and was getting costly repairs in the same Belfast shipyard where the Titanic was under construction. And this was when the switch was supposed to have occurred.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So I like that evidence that, like, okay, they were in the same place at the same time, like right before.
Yeah. But
I did a deep dive into this because I'm annoying and I'm here to burst your bubble about this theory.
That's okay. I burst it. We have answers now. That's fine.
So maritime historians say that switching the ships would be impossible.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. One key piece of evidence is the construction of the ships. Each has a distinct construction ID number or yard number that has appeared on a lot of parts, including wood paneling. So they put this on like a ton of the parts that built the ships, right?
Yes.
So the Olympics number was 400 and the Titanic's was 401.
Okay.
Multiple artifacts bearing the number 401 have been raised from the wreck, and items auctioned after the Olympic was retired feature 400. So every scrap of paneling, which took months to install on each of these two ships, would have been taken off both ships and switched in a couple of days in order for this to work.
Okay.
And there's a lot of paneling on those ships.
Yeah. So it's like, yes, impossible.
Yeah. So, yeah, if they wanted to switch them, all of that had to be removed. And so, yeah. And switched in like happening. 3 days.
Yeah.
It's so, not happening. Yeah. So J. Kent Layton, maritime historian, says this conspiracy theory is one of the most thoroughly disproven conspiracies about Titanic, and yet it remains one of the most popular and quickly spread. And so they're pulling up items from the wreck that still feature that 401 stamp, including the propellers, which still sit on the seabed. So if you can go down there in a sub and not die, you can go around to the propellers and see the 401 stamp.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which you can't really prove unless you go down there, but yourself, I'm sure there's a lot of people sitting in the comments like, yes, but there's, you know, what if they staged it and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. No one would go to that big of an effort to stage it, though, right? Like, come on.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. But, you know, there's a lot of crazy people out there. So,
yeah, it's fair.
So the sheer amount of people that would be needed to pull off the switch also really lends to the implausibility, Layton says. I mean, you need a ton of workers. It's like that same argument of like the construction workers that built the, like, the Batcave.
Oh, yeah.
They would all know where it was.
Yes.
So it was really open air. There were hills around the shipyards where people could see if they were doing that kind of work to the ships. Just ordinary people that lived in the Belfast area would have been able to see. We also know there were visitors to that shipyard and press who took photos of the ship during that stay. They weren't being kept out of the shipyard like there was something super secret going on.
Yeah.
There are even photos taiken at the time of the Titanic maiden voyage that show clearly defined differences between the two ships, even though they do look fairly similar at first glance. So, for example, the Titanic did not have a deck promenade or like a deck cover.
Okay.
But the Olympic did. And there are also noticeable differences between the window spacings of the two ships. And I provided a photo, I believe.
Yes, you have.
The Titanic also had its A deck enclosed and windows, and the Olympic did not. This was a feature never seen on the Olympic at any point in her career, says Layton. The enclosed A deck was also visible with a is also visible when you go look at the 3D digital scan of the wreck that was produced by the deep sea mapping company Magellan Limited. So unless they're also on this conspiracy theory, like, you can literally go look at the ship as it sits now underwater.
That's crazy. But the pictures that you put, I mean, it is a very clear difference when you look at the pictures.
Yeah.
Like, the window spacing, the window sizes, like, all that stuff. It's very, very visibly different.
Yeah, and they do look similar if you're just looking at, like, from far away, but...
Yeah.
It's just... And these are all things you can see on that scan, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So B deck was different as well, as the Titanic featured suites for first class accommodations, but the Olympic had an enclosed promenade for the first class passengers. So again, these can all be confirmed on the wreck along with those numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Both ships were surveyed by British authorities to ensure that they met standards. And this is Mark Chirinside, another maritime historian, states the surveyors that went over them and made the most detailed notes, right down to the last rivet, about repairs or maintenance that needed doing. You simply could not pass off one ship as another. The Titanic also wasn't insured for its full construction value, because the ship cost $7.5 million to build and was only insured for $5 million. So the sinking was a financial loss.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So that kind of negates that whole, like, insurance claim.
Right. Yeah, like, that wouldn't have made a difference anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So as far as killing Guggenheim, Strauss, and Astor, Strauss actually spoke favorably for the central banking system on multiple occasions.
Oh, and, wow.
Yeah. And Astor and Guggenheim made no public claims of support or lack thereof. And there's also no guarantee that all three men would have died, because I'm pretty sure John Astor survived.
Okay.
You know, and I'm sure if you're a crazy, intense conspiracy theorist, you could sit there and be like, well, you know, all the videos of the wreck of the Titanic could be faked and blah, 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 blah. And I've never been down there and I haven't seen it. So, yada. It's like the moon landing all over again.
Yeah.
So, you know, but that is that theory in
a nutshell. Well, I like it. I like how you were able to disprove that conspiracy theory.
Yeah. It was like, well, if you look at the two ships, here's all the differences. And get on the wreck. And here's all the numbers. And you'd have to switch all those panels.
Yes. Like,
so I think if maybe the ships didn't have, like, specific numbers attached to all of the parts, maybe that theory could have been more plausible.
Yeah.
But because you'd have to literally switch all of the parts, like,
it'd be because too much.
The Olympic was still getting worked on when the Titanic left.
Yes.
You know, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well.
There's that theory.
Yeah. I was like, well, there goes that theory. Yes.
It's either that theory or you're going to talk about the door, which. Everybody has their own opinion on the door.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. They do.
But they have both been on. I mean, technically, probably yes. But they didn't have enough alcohol before, so.
Yeah, note to self. The alcohol is important.
Key.
Yes.
So.
Key.
All right. Well,
good deal.
Let me do my sources real quick before I forget.
Yes.
So. I got most of Margaret Brown's information from mollybrown.org, all about Molly Brown, and then the Molly Brown Titanic facts from mentalfloss.com. And then for our baker, Charles Jochen, there's an article about him from All That Is Interesting. From TitanicUniverse.com, Titanic Survival Charles Jochen, and from McGill.com, which McGill is a university, and they have really dove into the whole, like, science of, you know, surviving cold water experiences. So, did you know head baker Titanic spent 2 hours in frigid water and emerged only swollen? And then I also looked at his entry in Wikipedia just to get an idea of the timeline, because a lot of these articles don't really work the timeline out very well.
Yeah.
And then for our conspiracy theory, there was an article from Reuters and an article from, I believe, NPR that I used. So I will put all those sources in the episode description.
Nice. So, good deal.
All right. Do you have a conservation corner for us today, or do we just want to finish with our happy things?
I do have an animal pulled up, but I'm okay just finishing with happy things too. It's whatever you want.
What animal is it?
It's a seahorse.
Well, now I want to know.
We snaw.
We snaw.
Yeah, I'll just talk about it a little bit because I have it pulled up and it'll be a quick
Okay.
little chat.
Okay.
So this is coming from PBS.org. So seahorses are found in a lot more places than I thought they were found. I thought they were only found in like tropical waters, but their range is actually like North Atlantic as well.
Yeah, I remember we had seahorses in the Chesapeake.
I know.
Lion seahorse.
Yes, I was thinking about that and I was like, oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So their genus is Hippocampus, which I find entertaining. There are at least 47 different species of seahorses. However, this number is likely to change with further research. They are typically smaller in size. They can reach about 11.8 inches. It looks like they can reach a little bit more in that height, but to a tiny pygmy seahorse measuring less than an inch in height. So,
oh
you
my
know,
gosh.
They range from very small to about a foot.
I love pygmy seahorses. They're so cute.
They're,
Little babies.
Yes, they are so teeny. Their weights vary depending on size, or I'm sorry, their weights vary depending on species, age, and reproductive stage. A seahorse typically weighs between 7 ounces to 1 pound.
Wow, a pound?
Yeah, apparently.
That's a big seahorse.
Yeah. I've never seen one that big. I've always seen teeny ones.
Yeah.
Their appearance. So they have a distinct appearance that appears to be a fusion of multiple animals with a horse-like head, monkey-like tail, and kangaroo-like pouch. The only male, or I'm sorry, only male seahorses have a brood pouch, though. So their eyes are like a chameleon in that they can move independently of each other in all directions. Also, like a chameleon, seahorses are masters of camouflage, and they are able to change their color and growing skin filaments to blend in with their surroundings. They are also known to change their colors during courtship displays as a form of communication.
Yes.
Unlike most fish species, seahorses do not have scales. They have an exoskeleton made up of a hard, bony plates that are fused together with fleshy covering. The crown-like structures on the top of their head is called a coronet, which is a group of spines. They have pectoral fins on either side of the head to help with stability and steering when swimming. However, despite this, seahorses are poor swimmers. They rely on their dorsal fin beating at 30 to 70 times per second to propel it along.
Yes, they're not fast.
Yes, yes, slow and steady.
Yes.
Their diet, seahorses mainly eat small crustaceans like amphipods and other invertebrates. Adult seahorses eat 30 to 50 times a day if available. They do not have a stomach or teeth. Instead, they suck their prey in through a tubular snout or a fused jaw and pass it through an inefficient digestive system. They are marine species, so they are found typically in seagrass beds, mangrove roots, and coral reefs in shallow, temperate, and tropical waters. Some species can also be found in estuaries, as they are able to tolerate wide ranges in salinity. In winter, some seahorse species move to deeper waters to escape the rough weather. Most seahorse species live in the West Atlantic and the Indo-Pacific region. And while it is long believed that seahorses mate for life, further research has shown that pair bonding is just for a few months at a time or during the mating season. They reinforce the pair bonding with an elaborate courtship display, typically consisting of a color change. The female meets the male in its territory, and as they approach each other, they change color. The male circles the female, and the pair often spiral around an object. When the display is over, the female goes back to her territory. When mating, the female transfers her eggs to the male, which he fertilizes in his pouch. So the number of eggs can vary, it seems like, from 50 for smaller species to over 1,500 for larger species.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a lot. In the male's pouch, the eggs receive everything they need from oxygen to food. The gestation time varies from 14 days to 4 weeks. The birthing process can last up to 12 hours. Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a while.
Yeah. Like most fish species, seahorses do not nurture their young after birth. The infants are at risk of predators or ocean currents, which wash them away from feeding grounds or into temperatures too extreme for their delicate little bodies. They have a survival rate of less than 0.5%.
Yes.
That's so small. Seahorses are largely solitary creatures. Aside from mating, most species form territories while males stay within 10 square feet of habitat. Females range over about 100 times that. Their territories will often overlap. The lifespan of wild seahorses are unknown due to a lack of data. In captivity, lifespans for seahorse species range from about 1 year in the smallest species to 3 to 5 years in the larger species.
Yeah.
A very short-lived species.
Very small, very inefficient.
Yeah. Poor guys.
Yeah.
Seahorses are hunted by humans to be used for medicine, as souvenirs, and in the pet trade. They are used for all types of medicine. Traditional Chinese medicine trade takes in excess up to 150 million seahorses a year from the wild.
Wow.
Yeah, that's insane. The curio trade also takes about 1 million seahorses from the wild. They are often sold as souvenirs. The pet trade also takes an estimated 1 million seahorses from the wild. Many of these taken in pet trade will not survive more than 6 weeks.
Wow. Oh,
God. That's so sad. That's collectively like 3 million just to those.
Yeah. Things. Well, and you've seen those like dried seahorses in stores, like at shell stores at like tourist destinations.
Yeah. I know. That's such a bummer.
I know.
Honestly, like I always thought they were fake, but now that they're real, I'm like, God, that's disgusting.
It's depressing.
Yeah. Other major threats to seahorses include bycatch, habitat loss, and climate change. Coral reefs and seagrass beds are deteriorating, reducing viable habitats for seahorses. According to the International Union for Conservation of Nature, which is the acronym of IUCN, Red List of Threatened Species, 12 of the 42 seahorse species that have been assessed so far are listed as vulnerable, with 2 listed as endangered, 1 as near threatened, and 10 as least concern. The remaining 17 seahorse species are listed as data deficient.
Mm-hmm. So, which that happens for a lot of species there's so many fish species and we don't have enough money and time to investigate all of them fully. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Numerous conservation groups such as Project Seahorse and the Seahorse Trust are working to protect seahorse species. Further research is needed to assess and protect the species.
Yeah.
That's what I got.
So that just brought me back to working at the Virginia Living Museum because we had one of the more successful seahorse breeding programs on the East Coast. That's right.
I forgot all about that.
So our species specifically was the lined seahorse, which basically stretches from southern Brazil all the way up through the Caribbean, the Gulf of Mexico. So we have them too in Texas, and then all the way up from Nova Scotia. So it's one of the more temperate species of seahorses.
Yeah.
And so we would actually capture wild seahorses from the Chesapeake Bay and successfully breed them in aquaria. And we got more than a 0.5 survival rate for our hatchlings, which you, they are as small as your pinky fingernail. If you cut your nails and you got your little nail, that's how big it is.
Oh my God.
Pinky finger. They are so tiny. They look like eyelashes. They're so small. Yes.
They are so adorable. Tiny.
But you have to make sure you catch when they're birthing the babies because they could get sucked up into
the filter system. Systems. Yeah. Aww.
So you have to go in. Well, we'd have a tiny little beaker and we just scoop them out throughout the day. Them to a non-pump, very small tank, which is a very small air stone. And they have to be fed constantly.
Yes.
And so we would get probably 10% survival rate typically. So we would have little teenage seahorses, which were maybe an inch in length. And then they would grow up and be big. And so because we were able to get wild seahorses, we were able to supply other aquariums with genetic diversity in their breeding programs. Because
that's cool.
Most breeding programs are based off of captive seahorses. Yeah. So
yeah.
That's my my seahorse breeding spiel.
Yes, no, that's awesome.
Yeah,
love that.
All right, So that was kind of a happy thing that made me little
Yeah, that was a
babies.
happy thing, wasn't it? Yeah.
But do we want to do happy things?
Yeah, we can do happy things. You
Yeah.
want to go first this time?
Yeah, I guess my happy thing is that I am home in Virginia for Thanksgiving, and it's the first Thanksgiving that I've been back to since we moved to Texas.
Yeah.
So we decided to do Thanksgiving instead of Christmas this year because Christmas is always crazy. And Thanksgiving is a much chiller holiday because there's not as much like tradition surrounding like all the different events and stuff. So
Yeah.
that'll be nice. And my brother's literally going to be here in like maybe 15, 20 minutes. So
Oh, yay. That's
yay.
exciting. Yay,
So
Ethan.
yeah.
Cool. My happy thing. Dude, honestly, I don't know. It's so hard to find a happy thing these days. I guess my happy thing would be that we are finishing our master bedroom up.
That'll be
I'm gonna,
nice.
yeah,
Yeah.
make that our sanctuary again.
Yes. I mean,
So
that's
yeah.
one more box to check off of the list of things to do at your house. So,
Yeah, I know it really is. It just, yeah.
yeah, it'll be nice.
One thing after the other. I will be very, very excited once we get a dishwasher in our house,
Oh,
though.
yeah.
Dude, I tell you what, it's so hard. It's like you make a meal and then the sink has dishes all like overflowing again. And I'm like, I just did these. Like, are you freaking kidding me? Like, what the hell?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
No,
That'll be.
we lived without one for 3 years in our other house, so I get
Yeah,
it.
I mean, honestly, like in college, for the most part, we didn't have a dishwasher. Like in the dorm, obviously there was no dishwasher. You just had like sink and stuff. In the next house I lived in, there was one. And then the house after that, there wasn't. The house after that, there wasn't. Like I had lived without a dishwasher for like probably 5 to 7 years.
Yeah.
So, like I get it, but it's like it's nice to have one for sure.
Oh yeah, like it's a game changer.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
But
Well,
yeah, that's my
those
happy
are
thing.
our happy things. Happy
Yeah.
Thanksgiving to everybody, because Thanksgiving will have already happened by the time this episode is released. But
Yes.
hope you all have fun with your families. And yeah, so where can our listeners find us?
They can find us on social media at Mother Nature Will Kill You podcast on Instagram. MNWKY podcast on TikTok and then on Facebook, Mother Nature Will Kill You. And then on our website, Mother Nature Will Kill You podcast.com. And you can find us and listen to us on any streaming platform. So that is your Apple Podcast and your Google Podcasts and Spotify.
Yeah. And if you had a couple fingers of whiskey and survived the sinking of the most famous ship in the world, we want to hear about it.
Yes.
But, or if your relatives or anybody who survived the Titanic sinking, like we want to hear about that too. But if not, if you just had like an uncomfy experience in nature, maybe you have been on a sinking ship or a sinking boat. I have, so it's not like it's that uncommon.
Yeah.
We want to hear about that too. So send all of your survival related stories to either we have a page on our website that you can submit stories to, or you can submit them to our email.
Yes.
In addition, if you want to support the podcast but don't have any money because we live in a post capitalist hellscape, you can give us a 5-star review on any of our listening platforms.
Yes.
Da-da. Okay.
Ta-da, we did it.
Yep, all done. We did it. My computer almost shat itself, but
But we got there.
we got through.
Yes.
All right.
That's funny.
So with that,
Until next time, stay safe, but most of all,
stay curious, explorers.
see you later.
Goodbye.